Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Roerink. Jack Spencer should be joining us here shortly. A little later in the podcast, U.S. Representative Dan Kildee from Flint will be joining us. And also State Representative Jack O'Malley, the Republican from Lake Ann. He was one of the Republicans who signed on to the Texas lawsuit challenging the Electoral College process, which obviously the Supreme Court shot down, but we're going to talk to him about that. But first, joining us is Jeff Timmer. He is with the Lincoln Project, former executive director of the Michigan Republican Party, and he's been fairly active this past political cycle, and it doesn't look like the year's ended yet for you, Jeff.
2020 is the gift that keeps on giving, and not in a good way.
I'm sure. So have you been officially ostracized from the Republican Party, or are you going to come back here at a certain point? What's going on with you?
If they haven't ostracized me, I've certainly ostracized myself. A couple of years ago on this very podcast, I said I was an independent leaving the party because I was shaking my head at what was going on at that time. And from that point on, the party said, hold my beer. And I'm shocked and I'm not shocked at the same time. I mean, all of this was fairly predictable that Trump would get increasingly worse. And since summer, I've been saying after the election was going to be the most dangerous time yet and the craziest time yet. Didn't really have to be Nostradamus to see this coming, but it's kind of playing out exactly like I thought it would. In these next 9 or 10 days, whatever, I don't think we've seen the craziest yet.
So at MERS News, Jeff, well, about 3.5 years ago, what we do, first of all, just for some background, during our Monday planning meeting, we have about a dozen of us sit around and just kind of talk about the news of the day. And you've seen the board. And one of the questions we had on the board was, does Trump finish his term? And it was pretty split between yes or no. But it's funny because here we are like 9 or 10 days away from Trump's scheduled departure from office. And we still don't know if he's going to finish his term.
I really think that we're on a trajectory that this is going to end with Trump and Rudy in a white Bronco going down the freeway with helicopters above watching the escape. It feels like that. It really does.
I'm curious, Jeff, what your takeaway is from this weekend's activities. I've been really surprised how fast corporate America has moved to sort of circumvent the speech of Donald. He's off Twitter. A Parler, as of last night at midnight, was taken down by Amazon. It's not available on Apple or Google for app download. Blue Cross and Blue Shield has moved not to donate to any of the folks that opposed certification of the Electoral College votes. It seems to me that corporate America could actually have much more impact on the trajectory of where this is going than the House.
Yeah, I think that they will. And what people are starting to realize, those who've been responsible, I know you said you have Jack O'Malley coming up in the show, people like him who've deliberately spread lies since the election have fomented this alternate reality that people are living in, are kind of realizing that the game has changed. This isn't a stunt. This isn't a being treated with the traditional political lens. This is after Wednesday, there's a palpable change in the way this is being dealt with. And corporate America is going to be voting with their dollars here over the next many months. And one of the things that the Lincoln Project and others are going to be doing is holding corporations accountable and holding these politicians accountable, those who were involved in inciting the riot, the Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley's. We are going to do everything we can to dry up their political dollars. And that extends to the congressional committees, the senatorial committees. If they are supporting these folks, we are going to be coming at their donors. There's going to be a price to pay. This isn't just political disagreement. This was an attack, a deliberate attack on the foundations of the government by people in the government using Americans to do their dirty work.
Well, and I wanted to bring this up to you, Jeff, because the responsibility then, it seems like, is being put on the public officials to educate people who are not familiar with the electoral process and to explain to the people why this was not rigged, why that the Electoral College process is continuing on, and We are going to have Joe Biden, and why that is. The responsibility here seems to be shifting. Don't you agree?
Well, yes, but let's not lose sight of the fact the only reason they have to now deprogram the masses that the election wasn't rigged is because they programmed them to think that. People haven't thought that American elections were rigged, were fraudulent, were third world Belarus and elections. But since June or July, Trump has been deliberately setting the stage for, if I lose, it's because it was rigged. All the people in Washington, in the state capitals, you know, we had half of the Republican caucus in the Senate signed on to a letter urging Congress to throw out Michigan's vote. That's not just a political stunt they knew was doomed to fail so they could, you know, cynically take that position to propel them with their base electorate. They're either cynically manipulating the situation or they're delusional and stupid. Those are the two choices for people who signed on to that letter. And there's consequences to that, and they're going to be paying a price. People like Jack O'Malley, people like Lana Tice and those other 10 people in the Senate, I'm going to see to it.
Jeff, do you get the impression, though, that this is not exclusive to Republicans, that we see the same thing on the political left where you have politicians who are forwarding positions that aren't necessarily designed to educate people but to fire them up? And, you know, if so, isn't that what was going on here? I mean, the ability to fire people up and appeal to their emotions as opposed to appealing to their common sense is not something that is exclusive to just the Republican Party at this point in time.
Certainly, motivating people to behave in a certain way is what campaigns do, for instance. You do invoke passion and urgency to what's going on. But it's usually, except for, I think, exceptions in our history, not been deliberate, planned lies. It's one thing to, you know, say that they're going to, you know, ruin your schools, you need to get out and vote. It's another thing to say, you can't trust the election, they're stealing it from you. This is all fraudulent. You know, 100,000 votes mysteriously appear in Detroit. Just so it's so toxic and corrosive, the rhetoric that we've seen, because it not only fuels this lie about what happened in the election, but it also, and I don't think this has been talked about enough, it plays into inherent and systemic racism within politics, because all of the accusations of fraud and whatnot, use Michigan as an example, have all been pointed at Detroit, not Oakland County, where the loss of Trump occurred. You know, Trump lost Oakland County by double the margin this year that he did 4 years ago. He gained votes in Detroit. This is all being done, I think, very cynically to play up the white anger that has populated Trump's base, the xenophobia and racism that they've been pushing for 4 years is culminating in this post-election period in a very destructive and corrosive way.
Well, the Lincoln Project's efforts that you mentioned, at sort of holding these people financially accountable, will that extend to the RNC? I mean, Ronald Romney McDaniel was part and parcel about their going out and spreading this misinformation for a long time.
Absolutely. Steve Schmidt's on Twitter saying it this morning. Going after her donors, she's culpable. She was spreading the lies in Michigan ahead of certification. She and, you know, Laura Cox. You got Ron Weiser still arm in arm with Michonne Maddox. She's on Parler last night spreading this article from Mike Flynn going to be vice president when Trump is still president after, you know, January 20th. Ron's got to own that or sever ties.
Or slowly try and convince people. I mean, that's really kind of the tough balancing act and the walking on the blade of the razor here, isn't it? And that you don't want to disenfranchise these people because you need them. But on the other hand, you have to explain to them why the situation is the way that it is. And can you do that by divorcing yourself and kind of flipping over to one side of the razor's edge?
Well, disenfranchise isn't quite the word to use, but the
Alienating. How about alienating?
Yeah, alienating. If Weiser, for instance, has done the calculus that he needs the delusional QAnon mega crazies in order to win a convention, and so he's made a deal with Meshon Maddock. I'll say that stories where you sell your soul to the devil seldom end happily. If he's made that bargain, it's not going to end well for him. And I don't think it's going to end well for the party, because that is the deal the party has made, is they've sat by for 4 years allowing this to fester and grow. It's not going to go away unless they confront it. This isn't a situation where I think they could be reasoned with. I mean, the people who believe these things believe them deeply, that the election was being stolen, that there's a deep state cabal. It's not like they're going to suddenly wake up to, you know, I've been, you know, freaking crazy my entire life, and now I'm normal and I can see reality. I don't think the epiphany is about to hit. As long as the party is deluding itself that that's going to happen, that this is something that can be accommodated and controlled, they're going to be in for a reckoning. And they're, I think, ultimately going to be continue to wither and die. You look at what the Republican Party has lost since Trump was elected. Just here in Michigan, Republicans controlled all the statewide positions, a supermajority of the congressional delegation, the supermajorities in the legislature. Those are the legislative majorities are the only thing that still exists very thinly, and probably won't after redistricting, or certainly they will be in greater jeopardy after redistricting. And I think that the party is going to be fighting a battle within itself as dollars dry up, some of the traditional dollars, and the party kind of looks inward and is fighting amongst itself in primaries.
I wanted to ask the question. Now, Trump's not the only one saying that this election was stolen. Everybody has been saying it on Fox News for weeks. It's been being said on conservative radio for weeks. In fact, if Trump was doing it by himself and those other things weren't supporting him, I'm not sure that as many people would be believing it as who apparently believe it now. So everybody gets indicted for this?
No, I don't know that everybody gets indicted, but I think there's a price to pay. Certainly, we had a situation last week with a majority of those Republicans elected in Washington. What was it, 139 members of the House, and at one point, 12 or 13 members of the Senate were actively involved in this. Most of them taking the cynical position was that this was going to endear them to their political base. And so, ha ha ha, I'll pretend that this was going on and I'll sign on to this political stunt. It blew up in their face. I don't know that they all bear the same level of responsibility. There's a difference between those who incited and led the riot, the Ted Cruz's and Josh Hawley's, and some of the backbenchers who were just along for the ride. I think that the folks, and like you mentioned, in the right-wing media, the price they're going to pay is loss of advertisers, loss of position. Cumulus Radio was out this morning saying that anybody who's now pushed on their airwaves, who's pushing this election lies, is going to face termination. That's the reckoning they're going to face.
So, Jeff, the folks who are now a majority, arguably, of the Republican Party, this Trump kind of contingent, the QAnon people that you had mentioned prior, where were they before? Because when you were chair of the Michigan Republican Party, they were not in control of the party, but they seem to be now. What happened, and where were they before? Were they voting Democrat, not voting? Did they just materialize like mushrooms? What happened?
To some extent, all of the above. I've said and written about how these people, the fringe elements, were always there, kind of lurking in the dark shadows and under rocks. I think one of the most visible examples is somebody like Randy Bishop here in Michigan. He was just starting to rear his head when I was over at the party, 15 years ago. And it's people like that we actively sought to keep under the rocks. We didn't give them a platform. We didn't give them a microphone at our gatherings and conventions. And they do now. They're embraced. They're party leaders. Michonne Maddock chairs the 11th Congressional District Committee. People like that have been elevated to positions of leadership and power and prestige within the party and embraced. And I think that's the big difference. And we didn't put up with the crazy. And now the crazy has become mainstream.
Before Trump, I don't remember any Republicans since 1988 coming even as close as 150,000 votes to taking Michigan.
True. No.
How can you characterize this as a cabal or just a small group of people?
I don't think it's a small group of people. Clearly, what was it, 75 million people voted for Trump, the second largest vote contingent ever in election history. It was just dwarfed by the number of people who voted for Biden. It underscores something, troubling within our country, that people looked at the last 4 years and said, yeah, sign me up for more of that. I've seen a good explanation of, there's about of, say there of the Trump 75 million, 70 or 25 million, a third of it is diehard, we will crawl across broken glass for Trump kind of people. Another 25 million are the diehard, just I've been Republican since I was born and I'll be Republican till I die. And if there's an R after your name, I'm going to vote for you. And then the other 25 million were motivated and believed the messaging on socialism and defund the police. And they saw what was going on and couldn't stomach the Democrats and bought into the Trump messaging. But it shows the divide in the problems that we do have, not just in our politics, but in our culture and society.
Jeff, just a couple more questions here before we let you go. What do you think the long-term prospects are now for the Lincoln Project after Trump leaves office, whether it's January 20 or before?
The Lincoln Project was very visibly anti-Trump. But from the founding, we've said that we're intended to defeat Trump and Trumpism. And so that was one of the reasons we went after the Trump enablers in the Senate. And that's really now what is going to propel us going forward. Trump may be gone, but Trumpism isn't. And the Marco Rubios and Ron Johnsons, who are on the ballot this election cycle, and the Ted Cruzes and Josh Hawleys, who are on in 2024, if they're not expelled from the Senate by then, going after the corporate donors, going after the board members of these corporations individually, if they continue to back this. That's where we're going to be focusing. And so the cancer has metastasized and it's beyond Trump's control now. And I think it's dangerous to our politics and our country that this continues, and we have to combat it actively and not allow it to continue to fester and destroy the country in a dangerous way that we saw last week Wednesday.
So if Trump dies of a cardiac arrest tomorrow, this thing still keeps going anyway, right?
The genie's out of the bottle, Frankenstein's monster's out of the lab, whatever you want to say. It's going to be different without Trump in the White House and without his social media megaphone. He's still going to be out there and he's still going to be in the news cycle even after January 20th. I think we can pretty much count on that.
One last thing I want to ask you about then, Jeff. So give us an example of a Republican who you feel represents kind of the future of where you'd like to see the party going.
So far, I think Pete Meyer, the very definitive statement he's taken against those involved in this inflammatory, delusional rhetoric, the statements he's made since Wednesday, I think, are very promising because you don't hear many Republicans making it. And I didn't support him. I supported his opponent. But so far, I'm very, very impressed with him.
All right. Jeff Timmer, he is with the Lincoln Project, former executive director of the Michigan Republican Party. Thank you so much for taking time, and enjoy the Christmas tree still.
Thank you.
I wouldn't be a Willie fan. Nobody swam the Rio Grande. I wouldn't be an American if it wasn't for Texas.
Joining me on the other end of the line is State Representative Jack O'Malley. He's a Republican from Lake Ann. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Kyle, anytime.
Well, Representative, I wanted to start with this letter that House Minority Leader Donald Luzinski sent to the incoming speaker asking that he discipline you and 17 other members of the Republican caucus if you do not disavow your actions in encouraging what she says is violence at the U.S. Capitol in taking part and signing your name onto this lawsuit that had been filed by the state of Texas to try and set aside President-elect Joe Biden's win and allow the legislature to decide Michigan's 16 Electoral College votes. I want to start by getting your response to that.
Sure. Well, I guess, first of all, I don't know if the minority leader ever bothered to ask me why I did it. I don't know if the minority, and I know she didn't ask me, I don't know if she ever watched the video that I put on my Facebook page explaining why I did it. So I guess I would guess, and I haven't asked her, so maybe that's turnabout's fair play, but I'm guessing the reason she did this is totally political. And she's trying to, you know, box people in. And I believe that's who our minority leader is. And so, you know, I think she can take her letter and stuff it because, you know, we still have free speech. We still have the ability. And what I did in that, and when I signed on to the Texas situation, I thought, look, if the I'm going to show support for this because if the Supreme Court of the United States says there's some issue here, I think that's important. And so I supported it. But I said, and it was public, if the Supreme Court doesn't take it up or rules against it, I'm okay with that. And I will accept what happens. And so what happened? The Supreme Court didn't take it up. So what happened? I said, okay, I'm done. And what's wrong with checking into or asking those questions? Now, a lot has happened since that first Texas brief, 4 weeks ago to today, and what happened, on Wednesday in the nation's capital. So a lot's happened. I get that. But ultimately, all I was saying was, Supreme Court, do you see a problem here? Is there something wrong here? And, you know, I believe a lot of people think there is a problem. And I believe there are a lot of issues, even in the state of Michigan. Secretary Benson says, oh, this was the greatest election ever. I think there were some real issues, like why did she send out all of these ballots? I mean, personally, she sowed the seeds, at least in the state of Michigan, and I'm talking about Secretary Benson. She sowed the seeds for a lot of this untrust because of did people get applications? I mean, let's face it. The average person's going to scratch their head and said, you know, Uncle Charlie's been dead 5 years. Why are they asking him to vote? So this is a very deep issue here that we need to talk about. And if you want to send letters and thump your chest, go ahead. But how about we sit down and we actually have a stinking discussion about what happened here in the state of Michigan and why people did what they did? But, I don't have a problem with it.
But do you think that President Trump had the election stolen from him?
No.
So then why sign on to the letter then? Because what you're insinuating here is that the Trump arguments were correct.
Because 4 weeks ago, I wasn't 100% sure.
Okay. I mean, you could disavow your participation in the Texas lawsuit.
But why? Because at the time, I felt it was a worthy thing to do. Mm-hmm. Did the Supreme Court agree with it? No. And what did I say? If the Supreme Court doesn't agree with it, I'm okay with that, and I'll drop it because now I have some proof that they don't feel it was stolen or that the case here isn't sufficient. I was okay with that. I felt that was a good, honest arbiter of what had happened.
Okay.
Now, that was 4 weeks ago. A lot of crazy things have happened in between.
A lot of crazy things has happened, and you put out a statement on this past week regarding what happened in D.C. Tell our listeners what kind of the crux of your feelings were on it.
I was, you know, like everybody, I was shocked, and it was shameful what happened. But what I believe is what happened in the Capitol was public protest, which 99% of the people that were there were doing, and they have every right to do it. When it moves to violence, that's wrong. Just as during our major this summer at our major cities, we had a situation where there were a lot of people, you know, peacefully, maybe a little raucous thrown in there, but peacefully protesting. That's fine. God bless them. I support them. But once it went to rioting, and I don't believe the protesters were the rioters, just like I don't believe the protesters were the knuckleheads, and I could use other words, but I try to be pretty nice, the knuckleheads that stormed the Capitol. Those people came with intent, just like the rioters in our major cities, I believe, came with intent. So it was shameful. But, Kyle, if any good, and this is what I think was the crux of that statement was, if there is any good that came out of Wednesday, maybe it will bring us back to actually having discussion. Maybe that shocked us enough to say, you know what, it's okay to have differences, and it's okay to talk about them. And if we do have differences, do you have to make some kind of political stand? No, let's just talk and work it through. And I hope we can get there.
As you're looking ahead to this coming session, what is the one thing that you would like to see work on?
You mean personally me?
Yeah.
Well, hopefully I'm chair of transportation again. Speaker Wentworth, if you're listening, please. I'd like to be chair of transportation again. And I've got some ideas on how to fix the roads, and it doesn't include 45-cent gas tax. Personally, then, I guess I have child care bills, because I think that we have a child care situation in the state that is, and in the nation, but in the state, that we have areas that child care is almost extinct. And we have to start looking at the fact that child care is part, is one of the legs of the three-legged stool. We need good jobs, we need affordable housing, and we need child care. And child care has been in the shadows, and I think that it's something that we need to focus on. And I had three bills, was working on three bills that basically the governor torpedoed at the very end, and said she wouldn't sign them, which I think was foolish. But we'll go back at it again this term.
Well, you mentioned roads to start off with, and obviously 45 cent per gallon increase is long in the rearview mirror. But is there some type of increase or other type of funding that we can put toward the roads? What is your vision on that?
Well, I think that we should probably, now that he's not here anymore, refer to it as the Chatfield idea of the 6 cents at the pump. I think that all needs to go. What I want to do is really work with appropriations as chair of policy. Speaker Wentworth, are you listening? chair of policy and the approach chair need to really sit down and with the tax policy chair, and you know, let's talk about where we're at and how we fund. Because for so long, I said this 2 years ago, I'll say it again, a roads plan was always just the budget. Well, I contend that it's also policy, and we had several bills that didn't make it for lots of reasons, but we can, our locals, especially now that the governor's fixed the state roads where they're $3.5 billion bonds, we need to focus on those local roads, and we need to make it easier for our locals to get better funding, more use the money that they have more efficiently so that they can fix the local roads. And that's going to take a little bit of change. It's going to take a little bit of people saying, okay, that makes sense. But let's look at this all together, not just the budget. It's how we spend the money we get. And our locals need more help. And we can get it to them quick. We just got to get people to agree to it.
Jack O'Malley, State Representative. One more thing I wanted to ask you about. You have become a popular figure on Facebook, and I know that you've gotten encouragement on your Facebook page to run for governor. Have you given it any thought?
You know, I'm flattered by that. And if I had any thoughts of running for governor, the last couple of days and the venom that's out there, that's one thing. You know, I don't necessarily agree with Governor Whitmer on a whole lot, but, you know, that's a tough position. I actually Kyle, I probably shouldn't say this because somebody will use it against me in 2 years, but I got a call the other day in my office. My staff said, some guy just called and said he was going to start a recall petition against you. And I said, good. Can I be the first to sign it? I mean, people out there are vicious. So, I don't know if I want that top job, man. Whoever gets it, God bless them.
Jack O'Malley, State Representative from Lake Ann, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Kyle, anytime. I enjoy reading mirrors every day.
Yeah, that's what we like to hear.
The poet and the wise man stand behind the gun, behind the gun.
Join us now on the podcast is the congressman from Flint, the 5th Congressional District here in Michigan, Dan Kildee. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it, Kyle.
All right. Well, the first thing we want to ask you is the scheduling. What do you see happening on Capitol Hill this week?
Well, today in a pro forma session, we'll offer a resolution by unanimous consent to ask the vice president and the cabinet to invoke the 25th Amendment. That will not likely proceed. So we'll vote on it tomorrow on the floor of the House and give the vice president and the cabinet a full day, 24 hours, to consider and determine whether they want to use the 25th Amendment to remove the president. Absent that, no earlier than Wednesday, we'll vote on what likely will be a single impeachment article, which I've co-sponsored, which I think will pass, and I think will pass with some Republican support.
It's probably the Senate can't take it up before he's going to be done. Is the plan then to sort of wait, let the Biden administration get its feet underneath it, and then have the Senate conclude it if that happens? And what's the benefit of doing that, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, if there was a will on behalf of Senator McConnell to move quickly, there's always a way. The idea that one senator can keep the Senate from acting in the case of a national emergency is kind of preposterous. We know that that's not the case. If Senator McConnell wanted to, he could have this on the Senate floor by the end of this week. He's not going to do it. So that does bring up the question as to whether or not we constrain the incoming president with this distraction or delay the Senate action until later. And I think that is in discussion right now. I'm sure you saw the Democratic whip, Mr. Clyburn, offer that it could be something we delay for 100 days or so. It's still important. The act of impeachment itself has some effect of law, prevents the president from executing some of his powers to pardon. Just the simple act of impeachment does. And then ultimately, if we take the final step of convicting him under the impeachment, removal from office is one of the penalties. The conviction itself is the finding of fact by the House and the Senate regarding the activity of a president. That's important, even if it happens after the president's gone. And another aspect of the penalty is that Donald Trump would then be barred for the rest of his life from ever holding any public trust, any office of public trust.
What specifically does that resolution, does that say that he did? Obviously, you can't just say that he said he got robbed, can it? It's got to be more to it than that, right?
You're talking about the impeachment article?
The actual impeachment article.
It will be inciting insurgency against the United States government. I mean, it's one of the advantages of a very simple article, and one of the huge disadvantages of this whole experience that we're in right now is that we all saw it with our own eyes. You know, people may come to different judgments. I question how anybody could see the president's behavior as being acceptable, but people can come to any judgment they want about his behavior. The question is whether we think it rises to the level where it should disqualify him from office. I have come to my conclusion on that already. Absolutely, yes. But it puts us in a position where there is not an exhaustive process regarding the finding of fact. It's simply the facts that are in public circulation, that are in public domain, that virtually, not virtually, literally every member of the House and the Senate who has a role in this saw play out before their very eyes. So I think there's a decent argument. Somebody said, well, it's unprecedented to move so quickly on impeachment. I'll stipulate to that. It's also unprecedented that the President of the United States incites, encourages, and gleefully watches a violent attack on the legislative branch of the government. That's kind of unprecedented too. So
you mentioned something I didn't realize. So if the House passes the impeachment articles on Wednesday, how does that impact his ability to issue pardons going forward?
Admittedly, the language in the Constitution has some room for interpretation. But one thing that is certain is that his ability to pardon himself is negated. It's arguable that his ability to pardon generally is constrained because the Constitution says that the president's authority to pardon is absolute except in the case of impeachment. In case there's an impeachment, not impeachment and conviction, but impeachment, it's left to that. I just so happened to serve in Congress with a constitutional scholar who has spent really his entire career looking at these very questions, a guy named Jamie Raskin from Maryland.
So could the pardons he's issued already be challenged on the basis he's already been impeached once?
That's a good question. I don't think so. Just thinking about it logically, because all of his previous acts as president are not negated as a result of an impeachment. And presumably, despite the fact that I think otherwise, the president's exercise of authority prior to impeachment is the authority that he has under the Constitution, and those decisions probably will stand.
We had these protests on the Floyd death last summer, and people were protesting, and as tends to be the case, other people showed up and they did rioting, which actually cost people their deaths. Can you hold the people who organized the protests as being accountable for what the other people who showed up did?
It depends. It depends on whether they had knowledge of this possibility and failed to act to prevent this. But there are varying degrees of culpability and varying degrees of criminal responsibility. It wasn't a protest. It started off perhaps as a protest, but by the time they reached the Capitol grounds, it was a criminal act. So even though there were these militia types who were clearly engaged in something that was far more nefarious, an insurrection with the intent to capture, try, and kill members of Congress, that doesn't mean the people who were guilty of lesser crimes that provided the space for that moment to occur. In other words, if just these militias had descended upon the Capitol, the firepower necessary to stop them in their tracks would have been present. The fact that they had 10,000 accomplices providing them cover, breaking the law by breaching the Capitol grounds, smashing windows, entering the Capitol, providing cover for them, means they have a degree of culpability. So I think there's a whole spectrum of responsibility that goes with this, and we'll see that play out in the charges that are ultimately filed against those who are captured. And believe me, they're all going to get caught. They decided they were going to put themselves all over social media because they believed they were going to prevail. They're all going to get caught.
Congressman, with the few minutes we have left, I wonder if you could sort of share with our listeners what your experience was on the floor. What's your story of that whole day was?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, I was preparing to lead the defense of the Michigan electoral votes because each state delegation, I'm the senior Democrat. You guys who've been around a while know how ironic that is, given the fact that I've only been in Congress now. I'm in my fifth term. But I was preparing to lead our delegation defending the Michigan electors. But it was going to be a few hours, so I went to the gallery to get a little more space, a little social distancing, so that I could observe the proceedings. And then things unfolded pretty quickly with the breach of the Capitol, first with the Speaker and the Minority Whip and the Majority Leader being ushered off the floor, then shutting down the floor, then us being ordered to take cover and put on the gas masks that we're all aware of, or the escape hoods that we are all aware of that are positioned under our seats. it was then pretty obvious that it was only a matter of time before they were going to break through one of the doors, because they were coming at us in from three different ways. Eventually, I'm sure you may, I don't know if you've seen any of the video. I shot some pretty bad, grainy video, but you can hear a gunshot and you can hear me make let's just say an exclamation that my mom probably wouldn't want me to make. And then that created a bit of a retreat from the mob, allowed a tactical unit to get into position. They were able to then clear one hallway for us to get to the escape tunnels, and we got out. But it was a long period. It was about 45 minutes. I was covered. I was taking cover behind a little half wall. And, you know, it was about two dozen of us that were left behind. Because when the Capitol was evacuated, the floor of the house evacuated, those of us that were in the gallery, we didn't have any way to get out. There was no door for us to get out. And so we had to have the police and this tactical unit that arrived, thankfully, you know, do what they had to do to get us out. And sadly, that resulted in the death of one of the people who invaded the Capitol. But that, who knows what would have happened otherwise. The thing that's been most difficult for me personally is that the more I've learned, both through what's been reported and other intelligence that I've been able to get a look at, the more I have learned, the more I realize exactly how much risk those of us that were left behind were really in. We were in a bad situation, really bad.
Were you surprised that after all of that, you still had members vote to object to the certification of the Electoral College vote in Arizona and Pennsylvania?
I was very surprised, and I think it's pathetic. And here's the thing. This has to be said over and over again. This is the classic case of a big lie. There's no challenge to this election that's valid. This was an election that was scrutinized more than any other election in my lifetime. It's all just nonsense. You know, there are lots of different levels of culpability, I will admit. But there's a certain level of culpability that I think is held for the most cynical of the participants in this. And it is those so-called political leaders that have contributed to this big lie because they saw the political benefit to themselves in doing so. Or perhaps more so, were so spineless that they were unwilling to tell the truth to their constituents who had been persuaded of this lie by their cult leader, by Donald Trump. And so I have a difficult time looking some of my colleagues in the eye in this moment. Because of all the shades of responsibility, I don't put them in the same category as President Trump or of those people who stormed the Capitol. But they sure took a hell of a risk that nothing bad was going to come of the lie that they helped to propagate. And if it's only history and the fact that they have earned the disdain and the disgust of people that they work with every day, if that's the only responsibility they have, that's going to be a serious penalty they face. Their names are written in stone forever, and they can't do anything right now to escape that. And they're mad. They're angry. Some of them have expressed their anger to me because I am not holding back, and I'm not going to. These individuals made an informed adult decision to take a fact that they knew to be false and pretend it was true because it benefited them at the polls. You know,
but that happens though, don't they? I mean, if I could, in the political sphere, doesn't this happen where you say something to rile up people and get them to support you? I mean, isn't that part of politics?
No. Okay, this is the whataboutism that I'm just about done with, to be honest with you, Kyle. And I know you have to ask the question because that's a question that's being posed. But if there's not a line over which you can't cross when speaking to your constituents, when it's not simply a matter of presenting one particular facet of a story, that is intended to support the position or the conclusion that you're taking, but to go so far as to participate in a lie that has real consequences, the worst consequence we've seen play out, but the best consequence that they could have ever hoped for is to undermine people's faith in the democratic process. And the notion, and I've heard some of my colleagues say, well, what about this and what about that? Some events and some moments stand alone in American history. And this is one of those. This is one for which there's no corollary. There's no example of, well, you did this, so we did that. This is a moment without any offsetting event. And here's the thing. They made a bet with themselves that nothing bad would happen, knowing that we have this deranged guy. They know he's deranged. They talk, and here's the problem with the whole, and I get the argument. I know it's not your argument, the argument that's being postulated. They know better. Privately, they say things like, I didn't really feel like I had a choice. They're going to primary me if I don't go along with this. And my view on this is, you know, at some point, if that's the position you take, just find another line of work. You know, and I'm not suggesting I'm the same position they're in, but my district's getting pretty Trumpy over the years. It's no fun. This ain't fun. And I'm about to have a redrawn district that I could be basically in the same position as some of these folks. I do not care. Throw me out. If I have to sacrifice my soul to keep this job, especially after, you know, it turns out it's a job where someone's trying to kill me, not worth it.
Dan Kildee, he is the congressman from the 5th Congressional District here in Michigan, Flint. So grateful for your time today. Appreciate it, sir.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Appreciate it.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Appreciate Congressman Dan Kildee for taking so much time with us here today. Also, Jack O'Malley and Jeff Timmer. We've got a lot of candidates for quote of the day today, Jack. What are we going to do with this?
Well, as you know, I offer my 2 cents worth, and it's usually only 2 cents worth because other people make that decision. And having also sat in that seat before where I was the one that made the decision, I still am jealous of it. But nonetheless, it's hard. There are those days where you wish you could save 3 of them for other days, and those are the other, you know, but you can't really do that. So this is one of those days.
You know, John, in the past, what I've done is I've tried to put like a poll on Twitter, but I can't quite figure out how to get all the characters in and have people vote. So that's always been kind of a, maybe I just got
to. We'll have to work on that. Like, I think I already know who's going to get it, though.
We've already, you know.
And since I'm closing tonight, I might have an inordinate amount of influence.
That may end up being your call tonight. Yeah. And we haven't even talked about banning guns from the Capitol. We're going to get all sorts of fiery quotes, pardon the pun.
Yep. Well, it's going to be a big day.
Thank you, AT&T, for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.
So you ride yourselves over the fields, and you make all your animal deals, and your wise men don't know how it feels to be thick as a brick.